Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guests believe in the power of learning from each other through respectful dialogue. After the election, a number of groups and individuals started projects to encourage people with different political views to just get together and have a conversation. Good old chatting. Offline, in front of each other. Today's guests, Justine Lee and Tria Chang, are the co-founders of Make America Dinner Again. It's a project that organizes conversations between people with different opinions over dinner. And Justine and Tria join us in studio. Hi, Justine and Tria. Thank you for joining us.
Of course. We're happy to be here.
Thanks for having us,
Rose. Great to have you. So how did you come up with this idea, Make America Dinner Again?
Well, the idea came a day after the election. I think Tria and I were both feeling a roller coaster of emotions, and one of them was a feeling of helplessness. And like a lot of the headlines and conversations that we were having with people felt like they weren't very productive and were hitting a lot of dead ends. And we felt also a deep curiosity to hear and know about individuals who had voted differently than we had. And I think that we wanted to put that energy, that kind of that feeling of helplessness, to something productive and something that felt like it was forward moving and positive. And so Tria and I both love hosting people in general, you know, among friends and family. And also we love to eat and love to cook. And so dinner and a warm meal felt like this perfect avenue for us to put our energy into, to get to know people from different sides.
What were you feeling after the election?
I think a lot of shock, and one of the strongest feelings that I remember is actually a feeling of shame at being pretty ignorant to what was going on in the rest of the country. And I felt like I prided myself on trying to stay up to date with things and read the news, and here I was completely taken by surprise. And I felt I'm definitely missing something. So when Justine emailed me and said she wanted to host a dinner, it made so much sense to me, and I was so excited. I wrote back in caps lock right away, and I was just like, yes, let's do this. I really want to hear from other people. And I did have a feeling of wanting to be understood as well. As we kind of move forward, Justine and I felt it was more important for us to actually facilitate the dinners and not state our beliefs, and create that space for others to do so. So that has been a shift for us.
Yeah. And talk about what went on behind the scenes. I mean, how did you decide how to do this? How many people to bring together? What did you tell them? I understand that there are games and guided conversations. How did you come up with all of that?
Yeah, I think it was just from our minds and talking to our experience hosting you know, get-togethers and parties among friends and friends of friends. And we just, we got together a number of times before our first dinner. We would talk on the phone. We were constantly emailing and texting. And we're just envisioning, you know, something. We were envisioning ourselves in the situation of this dinner and, you know, trying to figure out how to best facilitate among people that are walking into a dinner with, you know, seven people they've never met before to express their political beliefs. So it was just some good old, like, brainstorming sessions. We figured that we wanted a pretty small group of people to start. So our dinners are 6 to 8 people. We usually we want an even number of people because we do break up into pairs for some activities and conversations. And 8 feels like a really good number because it allows us to have a good diversity of backgrounds and perspectives, but also not be too many voices, so that to ensure that everyone has, you know, a chance to share and to listen. Yeah.
Now, do you make sure that half of the guests have certain views on the left side and half of the guests have certain views on the right side?
Yeah, roughly. Mm-hmm. So we have a sign-up sheet on our website, makeamericadinneragain.com, and we have people fill out some things about their perspectives. And it's not, I think one thing we've learned is that things are not so black and white.
Yes, I was actually going to ask you next, because what does that mean, left and right?
Exactly.
A few things would come to mind, like guns, for example. But how do you go about that?
Well, so we do have kind of the typical labels that we have people identify with, Republican, Democrat, conservative, progressive, libertarian. We also have an other button that a lot of people choose, and then they'll expand a little bit. And we found there is a lot more nuance in terms of how people view themselves. So something a lot of people say is, socially liberal, fiscally conservative, or they voted conservatively this time but not last time. So there, we try to gather kind of a half and half, like leaning right, leaning left, but that doesn't mean that it's for Republicans, for Democrats.
Yeah, and we also do have one open-ended question where we ask folks to share an interesting part of their identity or perspective that they're, looking forward to bringing to the table. And so that allows folks to kind of share parts of themselves that they're like, okay, this is what I'm passionate about, or this is a certain issue that I have thought a lot about. This is a part of my background or my upbringing that I think might be worth sharing or might be different than the majority in San Francisco.
That's really important. I was wondering how diverse these gatherings are in terms of background, race, income level.
Yeah, I would say that we've also made that a priority for our dinners from the start. We wanted them to be as diverse in background and income level and in age, gender, sexual orientation, profession, all of that. And so we really do value that open-ended question, and we do take some time to do a little light vetting of each of our guests before we officially invite them to the table. So that ensures that, folks are not just coming in and talking to folks that they'd run into in their social circles or at work. Yeah.
What really, now, is this just in the Bay Area?
No, actually, so we started in the Bay Area, but we do have people who've contacted us who wanted to host all across the country, so it's really exciting for us.
But you've only been in the Bay Area, but you're planning to travel, right?
Well, we've only done the Bay Area ones, but I've actually been working on training hosts in different states, so we've had dinners in New York and D.C., most recently Gainesville. We have some dinners that are in the process of planning in Wichita, Seattle, Denver.
Awesome.
Austin, yeah, quite a few places popping up, which is really exciting to us.
All right, so tell us about one of the most memorable dinners. What stands out for you?
Ooh. Do you want to start with one?
Well, of course, I think for me, the first dinner is always going to be memorable, just because we had no idea how it would go. We were really nervous. Everyone we told about the idea asked us if we had security guards or if we were ready for physical altercations, and we didn't, but we did have little
security guards.
We trusted. We had more faith in people than that. But we did have little what we call noisemakers. Sometimes we use bells. That first dinner we had kazoos, and we said if anyone is feeling attacked or unsafe or just shut down by the conversation, blow your little kazoo, take a break. No one actually blew them for those reasons. We kind of had a little song at the end just to celebrate. But the most memorable thing from that dinner to me was an exercise we did at the end with sticky notes. And it was actually just before inauguration. So there was a lot of kind of hope and anxiety at that time, and we wanted to kind of tap into what people were feeling. And the last exercise of that night, after some debate and disagreement, we asked everyone to write their hopes on sticky notes, and then we put them all up on the wall together and kind of read them aloud and placed them in areas where, if certain people agreed, then we would pool all those sticky notes together. And it was a really moving experience for me because I saw that, we all have almost the same hopes for the country and just different ideas of how to get there. And that felt for me to be a very good visual representation that we're all on the same team.
Totally. Yeah, that really stuck out for me, too. And another moment that really resonated with me was we had, this was a most, this was a recent dinner. It was actually back in August, the end of August. It was our, it was my third, I think at my fourth dinner that we hosted in San Francisco. And we had two return guests, and there was Min Mattson, actually, and Walt Scheflow. And they had attended a dinner previously and met each other, and they're two very different people. So Min is, he identifies as a transgender male. He's also a Korean adoptee, and he leans left, and he voted as a Democrat. And Walt is a middle-aged white male conservative and voted for Trump, and they have very different political ideologies, and that was something they learned at the first dinner they attended together. And then at the, but by the end of the first dinner they attended together, I think they were both from the Dakotas, so they had that in common. And I think they just saw each other's openness at that first dinner they attended. And then so at the second one, they actually greeted each other with a hug. And they were paired off for a partner activity, this radical empathy exercise, where they exchanged stories. And so they shared, so with this story exchange, they are have to ask each other two questions. The first is, what in your life has led to your political ideologies and your belief system? And what in the past year about your identity has been shaken, enhanced, or challenged? And so they exchanged those stories over the course of like 20, 30 minutes. And then we came back together as a group and they had to share each other's stories in the first person. So that was really powerful. Yeah, to hear, you know, to hear them say that, you know, basically speak each other's truths and realities was powerful for each of them. And by the end, I think they really bonded over the fact that they're both, they both first and foremost identify as fathers. And they really connected over that common shared experience. And so it was really moving to see two very different people who would not have met otherwise, who don't agree on a lot of the issues and probably don't fully understand each other quite yet, be able to, after a couple dinners, form a friendship. So that was very cool.
Well, that is Justine Lee, and we're also joined by Tria Chang, co-founders of Make Dinner Again, a project that organizes conversations between people with different opinions over dinner. And you can find more information about what they're doing. It's, as they said, it's spreading across the country. And there's a link at yourcallradio.org. You also have some videos there. And today we are talking about the power of getting offline and actually talking to people, having a respectful dialogue. And if you have any questions or comments about this, I heard a lot of people over the holidays say, this is the time when we get together with that uncle that we avoid, or you know, that relative that says some racist remarks, or that Trump supporter that we might not agree with. A lot of people were talking about this over the holidays. So if you had any personal conversations with relatives over the holidays, what are your thoughts about this? We'll talk about this later in the show, but also, what do you think about the divide that we hear every day? We are so divided. We're so divided. And I find that once you get together with people and actually have a dialogue, you find that you have a lot more in common. But the media love to say that because it's easy. And I think people also like to embrace that word. Mm-hmm. Do you find that also?
Yeah, I do think so. I think that it also helps with clicks and numbers.
Yep.
I think that's been proven. And I think that there are a number of talk shows where there are like opposing viewpoints and there's a little bit of debate.
That's the cable shows now. I think CNN has 10 people on the screen at any given time fighting about that over different issues. So we'll talk about that later in the show. But you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. And now I would like to welcome Julie Winokur to the show. Julie is the executive director of Talking Eyes Media. And in 2012, she began working on a documentary called Bring It to the Table. She traveled the country asking people about their political beliefs. And since then, she's combined screenings of the film with live discussions to give people the tools to listen to people they don't always agree with. And Julie joins us from Ann Arbor. Hi, Julie. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. So I understand that you started your journey after your son called you intolerant, and this was about 5 years after that happened. Why did your son call you intolerant?
I, like many people, I have very strong political views. I am also a newspaper and news junkie. I keep on top of current events, and I am deeply ingrained in my belief system. And at the time, in 2012, my husband and I tend to have political conversations at our kitchen table on a daily basis, and our kids do a lot of eye-rolling, and they're pretty disgusted with, you know, how intense we can get around politics. And one day, my son, who at the time was 17, said to me, "Mom, you're the most politically intolerant person I've ever met." Which I like to attribute to the fact that he was only 17 and hadn't yet left the cocoon of our house and the bigger world out there, which subsequently, and I can talk about that later, was the case. But at the time when he said that, he turned to me and he said, "You know, if the other side had a good idea, you wouldn't even know it because you weren't listening." And it stopped me in my tracks. And I thought, you know, he's absolutely right, because I am so prepared for the so-called other side to be wrong and to somehow, barrel head up into my belief system, that no matter what I was hearing through my news filter, my news bubble, I automatically assumed that it was a detrimental policy, it was negative, it was somehow going to undo progress, et cetera, in the way that many people I know feel. And so what I was seeing was my own behavior was indicative of what we were seeing in Washington. This is not soon before, around the time that Obama got reelected, we had that incident where he was called a liar on the floor of Congress, which, you know, honestly, in another era might have been libelous. It was treasonous. So I realized that I was very busy pointing fingers, because I was very upset that I felt that Republicans were doing everything within their power just to stop the Democrats from getting anything done. And so I, in turn, had to look in the mirror at myself and say, wait a minute, am I the same? Is this really a case where if I stop and self-examine, I would discover that I am no better than the people I'm pointing fingers at? So that was the beginning of my journey and why I took this insane pursuit, really, to go across the country and invite total strangers to sit down and talk politics. And I felt that if I could take that first step and become a better listener, if I could learn to undo all of that hardening, the callousing that I had allowed to happen to myself, then I could also role model for other people how this change takes place and become that sort of, you know, the change of one, you know, become that better version of myself, so that I could say, listen, this is what we all need to do. On a personal level, we have to take responsibility.
You live in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Where did you travel, and how did you decide where to go?
So I'm actually in Ann Arbor because my daughter is in school here, so I am just visiting. I live in New Jersey and traveled all over the country. And so we started out just locally in New Jersey, in New York City, and then even went up to Rhode Island at the time Netroots Nation was having its annual gathering. So it was really an intense gathering of liberals who are very vocal liberals, very politicized liberals. So I took it there just to kind of see, okay, what's it like if I go into the belly of the liberal beast, you know? Then I went down south and intentionally looked for towns that would be deep red locations in the South. Eventually, we went to the Republican National Convention, the Democratic National Convention. We came out west. We really tried to get a healthy cross-section, geographically, age, race, and political leaning.
What stands out for you, Julie, in your travels?
You know, to the point that was made before, and Justine and Tria, I love the work that you're doing. It's really exciting. And in some way, it's like I feel like what I did is the prequel to the work that you're doing, bringing people together. A lot of the discovery is about the nuance in people's beliefs. We tend to oversimplify our supposed enemy. And it's very difficult to do that when you're sitting face to face with somebody and you are inviting them to share who they are, what they believe, what they've experienced. You start to have a much fuller picture of who your fellow Americans are. It is extremely complicated. We are all ourselves incredibly complicated in our belief systems, and we fall into this binary interpretation just because it makes it much simpler. It's easier to belong to one tribe or another tribe. So, you know, that's the big revelation. And, you know, it sounds obvious, but until you are experiencing that face-to-face with people, it's very hard to accept it. And it almost, it's funny, I had a couple of people along the way tell me, I think what you're doing is dangerous. And I found that really compelling. And the reason they thought it was dangerous is this idea that if you open up the door a little bit, then these other people are just going to steamroll over you. You know, this is like roll up your sleeves and mud pit fight. And if you're going to be the nice guy, you're going to get trampled.
Well, Julie, in 2005, I did exactly what you did after George W. Won the second time. And everyone, I live in San Francisco, and everyone told me that no one would talk to me. And I mean, I went to Mississippi, Oklahoma, Utah, Montana, and everyone talked to me. Every single person, they invited me in for dinner. I went to gun shows and they hugged me when I left. And I want to ask you, and also you, Justine and Tria, about this whole idea of this divide, that we're so divided. You know, Julie, I find that if you meet, like, when I would meet hardcore conservatives, they would give you, like, a Rush Limbaugh talking point. But after an hour of talking about where their kid goes to school, if they have good jobs, if they make ends meet, if they have decent health care, what's the job situation like in their community? Have they lost a lot of jobs to offshoring? Are they going to rely on Social Security and Medicare when they retire? I mean, you just find that you have so much more in common, I should say for the common good. And that Rush Limbaugh talking point kind of disappears. But you can't, most media will shove a microphone in someone's face, get the talking point and leave. But if you spend more time there, you realize that, oh, they actually want to preserve Social Security and Medicare. I mean, it was just, that was striking to me. It happened over and over and over again.
It happened to me as well. And I have a... You know, a lot of times people will talk about I'm assuming I can say this on public radio, a bullshit meter. I think that there's the equivalent of a rhetoric meter. And we all spew the bumper sticker talking points. We all do it. It's not, again, it's not an us and them. I'm guilty of it. We are all guilty of it, you know. So what I try to do in my table talks is we get past the rhetoric. I'll hear the rhetoric. I let them do it. And then I say, well, tell me about your experience. You know, the bottom line is very few of us have expertise on the issues we talk about. We read whatever is our trusted source of information, and then we repeat it as though it's an original thought. So if you want to be honest with yourself, you know, there are very few things that you are qualified to own that degree of authorship on. But we are all entitled to our own experience as authorship. So if you can have the conversation around what have you experienced, what have you seen, who do you know, how does this impact the world you really, really have authority to speak about, it becomes a very different conversation. You know, so, I mean, like, I'd love to share a story. I was at College of the Desert in Palm Springs giving a presentation just a couple of months ago. And I had a student who volunteered to come sit at the table. And my presentations are such that I show the film, and then I have my table with me in front of the audience. I talk about the importance of civil discourse and the importance of the things we're talking about today. And then I asked for volunteers to come up and sit at the table, and we do table talks live in front of an audience. And it's amazing to me that whenever I do it, five hands will shoot up in the air of people who want to jump up and sit in front of an audience and share very personal information about their beliefs. And the first time I did it, I thought, I won't get any volunteers, you know. And so one person came up. I did a talk, and then I started to talk some more just in theory about civil discourse. And then all of a sudden, another hand went up. And this woman said to me, are you going to have more volunteers? Because I really want to come up. And I said, are there other people here who want to do this? And literally 10 hands went up in the air. So, you know, there is an eagerness to share in a safe environment where they will be heard. So the story a couple of months ago in Palm Springs, a student said, oh, well, I'd like to sit at the table. And so he comes up and he starts talking economic theory, and it's all at the 50,000 foot level. And I said to him, well, why is this so important to you? And he said, well, I'm really, I pay a lot of attention to how much money is spent on military. And he said, well, I served in the military, and a bunch of people in the room started applauding. And he kind of looked at me and he kind of gave me a little bit of a roll of the eye. And he said, yeah, I was about 5 years in the military. I was in Afghanistan. And it didn't take me long to see just how much waste there was and the fact that these people did not want us there at all. We looked like an occupying force. And all of a sudden, the room kind of went silent. And he proceeded to talk about what it was like to be in the military as a gay man who could not feel comfortable sharing his identity. And I think that what happened in that moment and the shift in just the audience energy in the room was fascinating, because to have this person who had the authority to speak about having served, what he's witnessed, and then also bringing in this question of gender identity had a profound impact on every person in that room, wherever they stood when they walked in the door. So that's to my point, that if you can take that conversation, remove it from the rhetoric and remove it from regurgitated information, and bring it to a place that has to do with that person who is in front of you, who can legitimately speak to, you know, their own first-hand experience. It is the game changer in all of this.
Julie Winnicore is executive director of Talking Eyes Media. In 2012, she began working on a documentary called Bring It to the Table. She traveled the country asking people about their political beliefs. She combined screenings of the film with live discussion forums to give people the tools to listen to those they might not agree with. We're also joined by Justine Lee and Tria Chang. They're co-founders of Make America Dinner Again, a project that organizes conversations between people with different opinions over dinner. On today's Your Call, we are talking about the power of respectful dialogue, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will be discussing the tens of thousands of protesters who have taken to the streets in more than 50 cities across Iran. They've been on the streets since December 28th, demonstrating against dire economic conditions and corruption. 20 people have been killed. More than 1,000 have been arrested. Also tomorrow, we will discuss coverage of the explosion of the Me Too campaign. We'll talk about sexual harassment, assault, and misconduct continues to rock media organizations. And then coming up next week, we're going to do a week-long series about the Me Too campaign, so I hope you can join us for that. Today, we are talking about the power of respectful dialogue. After the election, a number of groups and individuals decided to start projects to encourage people with different political views to get together and have a conversation. And today we're joined by Justine Lee and Tria Chang. They are the co-founders of Make America Dinner Again. This is a project that organizes conversations between people with different opinions. And they have these dinners all across the country. It's actually growing, and you can find more information about it at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Julie Winnicker, executive director of Talking Eyes Media. In 2012, Julie began working on a documentary called Bring It to the Table, and she's traveled around the country asking people about their political beliefs. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What have your experiences been like in talking with people who have different opinions than you do. And I think right now, because things are so nasty and ugly, how does that affect your opinions of, quote, the other? I mean, we turn on cable and everyone's yelling at each other. I mean, Trump says the most horrific things on Twitter about other people. And so how do you think that environment has really affected us on an individual level? 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's hear from John in San Francisco. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi, Rose.
Hi. Go ahead. Hey, you're on the air.
This is John from San Francisco. I'm so excited about this topic because I don't know if you remember me, but I emailed you something a while back about a project that I want to develop for kids to learn and respect, appreciate other religions of the world through the arts. And in a positive way, I mean, I'm calling it faith, you know, I'm not calling it religion, but I'm talking to a lot of people, and everybody that I talk to is real excited when I mention that where I'm trying to involve kids, and it's a sensitive topic, but it's really, I'm amazed how far this has come along, and the fact that I can actually talk to people, and a lot of people I talk to about this, their eyes light up when I tell them.
What is your group called?
It's a tool to teach kids. It's actually called Kids in Hand, and it's in early development, but it's using a doll, a CD, and a book to teach kids all the major faiths of the world. And it's just such a great idea. And you know, it's not. I'm glad I dropped the word religion, because religion is, you know, closes a lot of doors to people, but faith is such a great word, and I just wanted to share that.
Well, thank you for calling in, John. It sounds like a great project, and once you get it up and running, drop us an email. Thank you for calling in. Good luck with it. Let's go next to Robert in Richmond. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you, Rose. I wanted to just thank your panel members, and I think it's a great idea, and I hope I actually get to one of the dinners. I'm a big fan of a fellow named Parker Palmer, who has created an organization called the Center for Courage and Renewal. He's a Quaker, and he does a lot of retreats with people who feel kind of burnt out or at the end of their current career. But he also wrote a book called Healing the Heart of Democracy, which I used in 2012 and used it in a group. And the whole point of the book is actually to teach and practice deep listening and listening to people you don't agree with. His idea was that democracy is, in fact, a citizen-based institution. And unless we begin to stop thinking in terms of them and us and just listen to us, there's not really much chance. And I agree with that. So I just wanted to recommend the book. I think it's a very, very practical, user-friendly book with exercises. It's called Healing the Heart of Democracy by Parker Palmer.
Well, it sounds great. Thank you for that suggestion, Robert. Tria, let's talk about healing the heart of democracy. You had an interesting story, Justine, earlier about a conservative man and a trans man talking to each other. Tria, are there any other examples like that? Or what else do you observe when you find, when you hear, watch the people converse?
Yeah.
And I mean, obviously they're coming to the dinner, so they're interested in conversation and interested in learning about each other. They wouldn't be there. But what really strikes you about what you observe?
Well, my role in Make America Dinner Again is to kind of groom the hosts and train them and get them to do their own dinners. So actually something that I get to observe is a transformation of the host and not just the guests. And that's been really amazing for me, because Justine and I have felt it too, where you go in with a little bit of trepidation and you want to host these dinners, and you know you're inviting some people who may not agree with you or other guests, and there might be tension. But by the end, all of that fear and trepidation is really, it sounds cheesy, but it's really transformed into a great amount of love for all the guests, for everyone who took the time to show up, to share themselves. So I think Yes, guests do have some changes and growth as they listen to other guests, but the biggest change is for the hosts who feel kind of the, I guess, an uplifting feeling of getting everyone together and seeing what that does for everyone, including themselves. So that's something we've really been encouraging, getting more people to host. And I just also wanted to say we love what Julie is doing and everyone else who has projects that, you know, this is their way to help bring people together. We really believe that everyone has a different strength and kind of a different comfort zone. And it's great to kind of start there and see where you can go.
Yeah, and just to add to that, one thing that that's been sort of multiple proud moments for us is whenever we see guests from our dinners actually feel encouraged to host future dinners. So we've had a number of guests now, in particular I'm thinking of Nicole and JJ from one of our dinners, who they were actually paired in that radical empathy story exchange that I mentioned earlier between Min and Walt. And actually, so, you know, JJ is conservative and Nicole is more liberal, progressive leaning, and they also come from very different backgrounds, but they shared a love for travel and they actually shared a lot of laughs when they did their pair activity at that first dinner. And then so afterwards, they actually both expressed interest in hosting a dinner, so we decided to pair them up to host, and they successfully hosted a dinner just a couple months ago, and it went very well, and they had a lot of fun together. So I think that was great to see, that evolution, and we're just continuing to seek those opportunities to have, you know, our guests also have, if they'd like, the experience of hosting, and just continuing to grow and spread that way. Hmm. Yeah.
How do you think, when you talk about there's a lot of compassion at the dinners, people leave feeling really not good about themselves, how do you think the toxic dialogue that we hear, the cable shows, the tweets, it's just nonstop. How do you think that has affected the people that you're getting together with? I mean, in general, if you're saying that someone said you needed security, and Julie, if you're saying that someone said what you're doing is dangerous, I mean, that tells you a lot about how this toxic culture is really affecting us. How do you think it is affecting how we see each other? What do you think, Tria?
I think people are affected by it and they're tired of it. And for myself personally, I don't want to go around in life hating people. I don't want to be filled with fear and hate. I want to understand people. And I think one place that particularly depresses me is the comment section of any online article about politics. So I do see that there's a lot of animosity online because people can just kind of, you know, throw down their gauntlet and leave, or just, you know, say things to win instead of saying things to grow understanding and to kind of open up the conversation. People are always trying to shut each other down online. So actually, one project that we've started to do is take the learnings from our in-person conversations. And because there are so many people online and it is so accessible, we are having people who've signed up for our dinners, we invite them to join a Facebook group. And this is a discussion group with very kind of similar parameters to our dinners. We have ground rules, we have discussion prompts, we have emoji symbols you can use when you feel like the conversation's not going well. So this is kind of our interesting online experience to see if we can shift that a little bit.
And Julie, what are your thoughts on how the culture, the media, the tweets, just hearing every day that we're divided and Washington is broken, how do you think that's affected people?
I think it's the media is incredibly manipulative, and we are fooling ourselves if we do not accept the fact that it's a commodity that relies on, you know, clicks and viewers and likes and followers and all of this, you know, ratings. You know, we are being commoditized in that way, and it is so much easier to get engagement if you're inflammatory than it is if you're serious and thoughtful and, you know, more moderate in your coverage of what's happening. So I think that it is a dangerous and slippery slope that we have to resist. I see it on the left and the right. I'm very concerned. Even all the alerts I get on my phone, every time I see a New York Times alert, it makes me panic a little bit. And I know I'm not alone in that. I have so many friends who got fired up after the election of Donald Trump, who then said, I am on a news hiatus because I was finding myself getting too upset and it was causing anxiety. And that's troublesome, because if the media is going to push us so far that we don't, that we want to shut it out, then something really, really dangerous is happening, you know? So I'm very skeptical about the intent. Because I think we're being manipulated by a lot of media. You know, CNN's ratings are better than ever. They're probably at an all-time high, would be my guess. I've heard that they, you know, have certainly seen a surge. On the flip side, I will say I am encouraged by the amount of engagement I've seen since the presidential election, where people are paying attention in ways they were not prior to that. You know, and I'm sure we can all attest to that, you know, having witnessed this before the 2017, I'm like blanking out what year I am. We're in 2018 now. what year's in 2016? But I feel like before I, when I was on the road with people, I'd often hear, well, you know, I'm not that well read about there. I'm not really sure what's happening. Well, people definitely woke up. They definitely started paying attention after this election in a way that I find encouraging. I just think we have to resist the urge to get fired up in a way that is a negative. We're not just fighting against something. We have to be fighting for something.
Did you talk to people about power structures and what does that look like? Because as you said, Julie, it's in the, especially the cable shows, but other media outlets' best interest to just have fights. It's the old divide and conquer, right? Especially with politicians. We want you to think that this guy's taking your job, so be mad at him, not your boss, because he's not paying you a living wage. And that's the other thing that struck me when I talked to people about power structures. Almost everyone said that there's too much money in politics. They don't believe politicians are working for them. And obviously that was a theme during this election. But can you talk about that? What comes up in these discussions when you talk about power structures? And maybe it's in their best interest if Justine and Tria, if you fight amongst yourselves, but don't get together and say, actually, I'm the problem. The system is the problem. Did that come up? Julie?
Yes, definitely. On my end of things, absolutely. And that's a lot of when we sit down and have these table talks and somebody can immediately jump into, well, immigrants, I think everybody should come here legally, yada, 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 you know, mm-hmm. all the things you've heard. And so to shift that conversation, you know, again, back to the personal, the first question is, have you seen that happen? Have you seen an immigrant take away a job that you or someone in your family wanted or, you know, was forced out of? So let's bring it back to what can we speak about that, you know, we can bear witness to, or we have evidence of, rather than assuming that these vague enemies are legitimate. So a lot of it is being able to shift that conversation, because there's no doubt that it's like a bait and switch kind of thing, where if we can demonize some abstract group of society, it makes it much easier for the powers that be to continue to control things, you know. So there is no doubt that if we can bring it to the ground level, stop talking about what's going on somewhere thousands of miles away. Let's bring it to the ground level. Let's talk about what we know is happening. And in the same way, you have to enter these conversations willing to learn something. So the thing that always surprises me is I'll talk to somebody about bring it to the table, and then they'll say, well, have you convinced anybody yet? And I say, well, that is so, that's the opposite of what I'm trying to do. Because I'm not in a conversation so I can sway someone and convert them to my point of view. You have to be willing to enter a conversation saying, what can I learn from you? I don't agree with you. And I might not agree with you when we leave this room, but I'd like to know, what is it that has you believing what you believe? And is there something in there that would enrich my understanding of the world? And so it is such a different approach. And, you know, my favorite quote in all of my travels, all of my talks, was the guy who said to me, you know, in America, our idea of listening is waiting for the other person to stop speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. No, we've felt and experienced the same thing at our dinners. We feel like one of our mantras is seek to understand and then perhaps to be understood. Just going in, you know, we get that question a lot too. Has anyone changed their mind? Mm-hmm. Have you convinced anyone? You know, and like you were saying, make America dinner again. That's not the point of our dinners. We know it's going to be a slow process. We're not trying to change the currents or you know, change anyone's minds overnight. We know that's not possible. So we're okay with our part of the solution being a little bit of a slow process, and we're okay with it taking time. But it, like you said, Julie, it's really important for us to go into the dinners just ready to listen and ready to hear people out.
We have an email from Virginia who says, I love the idea about listening to the first-person point of view, people who talk about themselves. What I really want to do is work towards political decisions based on science and statistics and economics. These tools can help us predict cause and effect on policies, but people, myself included, do not trust statistics. Personal anecdotes are often used to make overarching policies. I would like to know how to promote trust in science again so that we're not making knee-jerk decisions based on anger and fear?
That's a great question.
I think, like
anything, I think there needs to be a balance. So we have to have those facts and statistics, but we also need the personal anecdotes to be able to relate to them. So I think if we can move towards increasing sharing both of those things and using both of those things in our policymaking and in our understanding of one another.
Julie, anything to add?
Yeah, I think also there is no substitute for exposing people to people of different opinions. And I think the value of what we're talking about today is in reining in the radicalization of Americans. And I think this is all tied in. It's tied in, Rose, also to your question of the power of the media. There, we are in a moment where people have become more radicalized and they interact less and less. And all the research shows us that when there are no opposing opinions in a conversation, in dialogue, the group as a whole moves to a more radical stance. So I think that, you know, I value immensely this question of the data, the science, and whatnot, but you are not going to shift people's idea, their opinions, their beliefs on data alone because of this distrust. You've got to combine the data with the personal exchange of ideas. And so that's the sweet spot.
Let's hear from a couple callers. Let's go to Paul in Oakland. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Hi, I just wanted to offer, I signed up, first off. I think it's a brilliant idea that you all are doing here. And then a couple comments. One, earlier on the show, you talked about a safe and civil environment. And I wanted to just make the point that safe and civil doesn't mean that it can't be uncomfortable. And then the art in all of them hosting these kinds of things is managing the discomfort around the table. But fundamentally, I think this is a great idea. The other thing I wanted to say, I think it was Julie, I totally agree. All of this stuff has to lead with relationship and trust. You can't even bring data and science in until you've built trust across people who for instance, go on with, would think, oh, okay, I trust you to bring an unbiased source of numerical data to this discussion. And then after that, just keep up the good work. Like I said, I signed up and I look forward to joining some of these dinners. Take care, y'all. Peace.
All right. Thank you so much, Paul. We have just a couple minutes left. Justine, as you said, Make America Dinner Again is expanding across the country. What are you hoping that it accomplishes, or what are your hopes for this year?
Yeah, my hopes for this year that we have a less polarized midterm election season, and that, you know, people are going in at least with the folks that we've been able to reach in the Bay Area feeling like there has been a transformation that they've seen over the past year, having participated in the dinners, just continuing to grow and reach more people. Like I said earlier, we realize that it is going to take time to reach as many people as we can in the United States, but with opportunities like this to share with the Bay Area audience, like just the more people that we can reach with this idea and this approach to living and to relating to other people, that's what we're all about right now, is just continuing to grow in that way.
Tria?
Yeah, absolutely. We just want to grow and support more dinners happening. So we do have a GoFundMe on our website that helps people pay for these dinners, because they're so generous and doing it from their own pockets unless we help fund them.
And Julie, what are your plans with your film?
So the film is well done, and now all of my work is around these interactive events. And so moving forward, we're actually expanding to do 10-table events where we're training facilitators so that we can actually have a much more kind of public, larger display where each of the tables is facilitated and we can engage a lot more people, because it really was always intended to be something that would go well beyond me and ripple out wide and far.
Julie Winokur is executive director of Talking Eyes Media. She worked on a documentary called Bring It to the Table, traveling across the country, asking people about their political beliefs and then having discussions based on the film. Justine Lee and Tria Chang are co-founders of Make America Dinner Again, a project that organizes conversations between people with different opinions over dinner. And you can sign up for a dinner. Find the link at yourcallradio.org. Julie, Justine, and Tria, thank you all for coming in. And Julie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. Since December 28th, tens of thousands of protesters have taken to the streets in more than 50 cities across Iran. They're demonstrating against dire economic conditions and corruption. We'll discuss that. We'll also talk about coverage of the ongoing Me Too campaign. Your Call is produced here at KALW. If you'd like to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show, and we are happy to have Laura join our team. Lauren Schechter is our social media producer. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.